Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, we recorded 3 or 4 days ago, mentioned that we were looking to put together a podcast recording either at the first of the week or at the end of it. So here, happy to say we've been able to convene on a Sunday evening, and we'll have this out first thing Monday morning. Predominantly, we will devote this podcast to listener questions. So a lot of questions have built up over time. We've done our best to grab as many good ones as possible. If we don't have your particular question on here, I apologize. Do not read it as though either of us took it that it wasn't worthy or anything. We just can only answer so many questions. So, Bud, let's jump right into our first question, which will also serve as a solid reminder to all as to our friends and sponsors of this podcast and how much of a positive benefit Louisiana Hot Sauce has had on what the Nolcast has ultimately become.
All right, I'll ask it, and you can start. Ingram, this comes from – actually, I didn't put the names on the questions this week, so it would take too long. What are your favorite things to use Louisiana hot sauce on other than the obvious?
Other than the obvious, I'll tell you, I mentioned something a couple months ago that was received or at least had a decent amount of interest surrounding it, and that was that I would just cut an avocado in half, just put some grated cheese in the middle and a little bit of seasoning and – Louisiana hot sauce if I was looking for a real quick lunch or maybe a kind of a bite to eat but not an entire meal. So a lot of people were interested in that, and the people at Louisiana Hot Sauce actually sent me a recipe that you would just do that, cut it in half, basically exactly what I was saying, but throw it in the oven for 25 minutes. And that, I can tell you, was absolutely incredible and something I'd suggest, and I'll try to find the link to that particular little mini recipe. But we had a tweet a couple hours ago from Cole Cochran. Cole seems to know his way around the kitchen. Said, artisan toast, cream cheese, a fried egg, and a little bit of Louisiana hot sauce and grated Parmesan as kind of a cheese toast, eggs and toast combination as a morning breakfast. And Cole, I will tell you that I will, I'm not huge on bread, but I will try that in the next couple of days. Certainly looks pretty impressive, and maybe yet another item that I would add to the list of things that I enjoy Louisiana hot sauce on that I would not claim as the obvious.
See, I was going to say oysters. So Cole wins this, man. That is, I guess my oysters are kind of obvious, but I do like delicious Louisiana hot sauce on oysters. I actually like it instead of cocktail now, just little dash of hot sauce, and you're good to go with it. Cole's recipe looks delicious. And in fact, if you're one of those listeners that listens to us by going to Tomahawk Nation, I'm actually going to put this, embed this in the article that we usually put up with the podcast. So, Cole, appreciate that. If y'all have good Louisiana hot sauce recipes and you feel like tweeting them with good quality photos at us and at our sponsors, that's LA_hot_sauce, please do so. They certainly seem to like it a lot.
All right, Bud, jump into the next question here.
All right, Ingram, any update on roster happenings? I think this is referring to, like, how is FSU going to get down from 86 to 85? And I've got nothing really new on this. Tomori and Terry, the receiver out of Georgia, tweeted that he would be arriving soon. That does not necessarily mean that he's, you know, fully qualified and whatnot. We've seen kids certainly before be on campus and then have to leave because they didn't actually qualify. But I think it's a positive sign. But as far as who else is going to not be on the roster, because I think with Terry there at 86, I actually don't know. I was waiting on word with one offensive lineman who I was told may have a grades issue, not a starter, so, and not somebody who I think is going to compete for a starting job. So if you're worried about that, other than just the kid's welfare, don't be. I don't know, man. This is going to be interesting. I think the three that we nailed down, the Kilby Lane, Kerr, and Bryant, were sort of obvious types.
Yeah, I think I don't know that. Well, I certainly don't know who the other one would be. And it may be that, you know, Florida State is able to take advantage of a situation that presents itself, and this this situation kind of resolves, comes to its own resolution. But no, I don't have anybody in the back of my head that I would be able to point out. And obviously you mentioned the three that you did a couple weeks ago, and that very much ended up coming into play. So we will keep you updated. Doesn't sound like you've got immediate answer, and to be honest, neither do I.
All right, Ingram, next question here. Who locks down the starting corner spot opposite of Tarvarius McFadden this year?
That's a good question. Certainly something that you've heard a lot of. You know, it's one of the frequent questions from the fan base, and a lot of times what if I bump into somebody. I've been posed this question a couple times. I'm not positive of this. I'm really kind of interested to see how they use the positions that they have, and I know that they were looking at working a couple different kids at a couple different positions. Bud, at this point, who would you think that would be?
If I had to take a guess, and look, I do think there's going to be a legit position battle there, right? This is not like a slam dunk, I don't think. Man, Kyle Myers played pretty well last year when they put him in. Obviously, everybody who was young in that secondary had some growing pains, seemingly, other than McFadden. But Myers, a year older, we know the staff likes him. I mean, he does what they ask of him. He's usually in the right spots. He doesn't blow a whole lot of assignments. I think he might be the guy, if I had to bet on somebody, and I'm very glad I don't have to do that, he might be the guy I'd pick.
Yeah, he would be the name for me as well. But I think a lot of time left for this one to be decided. And as you mentioned, I would have Myers in front, and he played. I would describe his level of play as capable. I think that's a good term. But like you mentioned, nobody has this locked up, and this was, or this is, and will be one of the real true battles that we look at in fall, and we'll have a chance to watch a little bit of healthy competition at the opposite cornerback position away from McFadden. Third question, Bud, who is the most intriguing freshman that hasn't played in the spring but that could compete for playing time?
So I guess we're also – this is just true freshmen who are arriving on campus recently, right? I think, because it wouldn't include the early enrollees.
Yeah, I believe this question is to – basically put the group that does not include the early enrollees out there.
So I'm going to have to Google to make sure that I'm thinking about who is actually on campus for spring. You got anybody off the top of your head?
Has a chance to be, well, not necessarily a starter, but has a chance to come in, immediately contribute for playing time.
Yeah, I mean, most of this team came back. You know, so, all right, Ingram, you can't pick Akers. You cannot pick Kando.
Right.
You cannot pick Samuels. You cannot pick Fagan. And you cannot pick Hockman or McKitty or Adonis Thomas, who's not a freshman, so you can't pick him there. But you also cannot pick him because of
when he got on campus.
Right. He early enrolled.
I'm not trying to, and this is the facet that makes this question interesting. And I'm not trying to cop out of it, but all the freshmen that you have a real good chance of completing for playing time, or maybe even end up being a starter, were the ones that you basically just disqualified.
I agree. It is an artfully crafted question.
The way in which the question was stated.
All right. So there are a couple guys I thought about here. Marvin Wilson, just because of his size, and it looks like he's gotten in somewhat better shape than he was as a recruit, which is a good thing. Maybe DJ Matthews, you know, either in the return game or in a slot receiver capacity. They don't have many proven receivers, right? And DJ certainly has the agility to run good routes. Let's see how quickly he picks up the offense. Would have loved if he'd been able to early enroll, but he didn't do that. Other than that, I don't know. I mean, Zaquandre White and Kalon LeBourne are two really talented running backs, but you already have Akers, who was the best of the group, in my opinion, and he's already on campus. I don't know, man. I don't know if you're going to get a whole lot of immediate out of the non-early enrolled freshman class.
Yeah, I think the two names that you listed are good ones, and Wilson, if Wilson's in good shape and does what he needs to, I mean, then that's probably the best answer to go with. I would love to think that you could see the kid out of Jacksonville in maybe a punt returner role, but, I mean, last year, all that talk about Levante Taylor wasn't just stuff that people were making up. I mean, that looked like he had a real good chance to end up being the punt returner, and it just never came to fruition. So I think I personally am going to abandon trying to read tea leaves and figure out who's going to win that position, and we'll just wait until somebody tells me. But Taylor is either a situational wide receiver as a punt returner, or Wilson, as he kind of works his way into the college game, are probably the two best answers that could be had from that group.
All right, Ingram. This is a question that a lot of readers submitted. I don't know whose name to put on this. David Hale, the writer for ESPN, who I think does a great job, and I'm so glad is not one of the ones who got laid off. Not that I'm glad anybody got laid off, but I'm really glad they decided to keep him. He was asked on Twitter, who are the top ACC defenses? And he answered, just, and this is, look, it's on Twitter, so it's not super in-depth. He just, in his opinion right now, he said, overall, I'd probably go Clemson 1, Miami 2, FSU 3, NC State 4, and Virginia Tech 5. But Boston College is solid, and Louisville and Wake Forest are wild cards because they have new coordinators. Which, by the way, I don't know if you all realize this, Notre Dame took Wake Forest's excellent defensive coordinator, so I'm glad to see that guy no longer in the league. A lot of people kind of react to this and like, what? How is FSU not the number one defense? And you know, how could you really put Miami or Clemson ahead of FSU? Reactions kind of like that, and they wanted our thoughts on David's thoughts, I guess.
I saw that, and certainly was a lot of it's interesting, like where off-season conversations come from. You'll see all this talk. All of a sudden, you have to try to figure out what the source of this debate or what people kind of found to bother themselves. And I saw this. Look, I would put Florida State above Miami, but look at what Clemson's recruited and look at what Clemson has just along its front four. I have no problem with somebody saying that would be the group. I don't think anybody from a Florida State perspective is necessarily a homer to talk about the fact that they could potentially have the best defense in college football. So I think that's just more an acknowledgement of the way Florida State and Clemson have recruited. I would take exception to Miami, but that's a. Yeah, I mentioned this last week when we had a little bit of a divergence of opinion as to who would be the more dangerous opponent, Florida or Miami. I'm more than willing to note how talented Miami's defense is and their front seven in particular. So I think there's a drastic drop off between those three, but I'm not sure that this is anything other than just kind of like a little bit of a off-season thing to find disagreement with or try to find a slight from a national writer.
Yeah, exactly. Look, David does a great job, and yet last year those two defenses were better than FSU's. So it's not like he's stating something that has never happened before. They were better last year, I think. Could they be again? Sure. Do I think both of them will be again? Probably not. I think Miami's front seven will be really, really good. I'm not totally sold on how Miami's secondary will be. And, you know, there are some teams this league can pitch the ball around a little bit, far fewer than last year where they had a best quarterback year in league history. But look, if Florida State gets its act together and is well coached, and it better be, then I do think they have more talent top to bottom than Miami. So I would have them over Miami. And I think you're right. The overall debate is probably – who do you like better, FSU or Clemson? I would take Clemson's defensive line over FSU's, and I know FSU fans don't like to hear that, but I think they have the two most talented players if you were to kind of combine the groups, and so I'm going to go with the studs. But I think Florida State has a good chance of having the best defense in the league, and like you said, an outside chance of probably one of probably 8 or 10 schools that you think could actually have the best defense in the country if everything comes together. So I wouldn't take this as a big-time slight. What we don't have here is magnitudes. David didn't say, I have Clemson by a mile and then Florida State and Miami close or anything like that. It's Twitter. It's 140 characters. You don't really get to put a whole lot of nuance. That's part of why I don't tweet as much anymore, because people take things the wrong way seemingly on purpose. And, look, I don't think FSU fans are doing that here. It's Twitter. It's fun to have some engagement, but – If David really wanted to show a whole lot of nuance in that take, he'd probably go to his Facebook page, and he often does, so I'd encourage y'all to check that out.
All right, Bud, we've gotten through a couple of good questions here. Let's leave the question and answer pattern here for just a second and talk about the one bit of timely news. That is, Florida State picks up a pretty significant offensive line commitment from Georgia kid Warner Robins, Central Georgia. Christian Armstrong goes to social media today to declare that he has committed to Florida State.
Yeah, this is a good get. Christian Armstrong, pretty good size, 6'4", 6'4 and a half, I believe, north of 300. Got to see him a couple times this offseason. One camp he was pretty good. The other camp I thought he, you know, needed some improvement. But, hey, that's kind of the nature of what it is. You're in high school. You're going to keep getting better. Listed as an offensive tackle. I'll be interested to see if he stays there. I think he may let me say this. Certainly, I think they want him to start out at tackle. If he can't hack it at tackle, I do think there's a really good chance he could be a damn fine guard for FSU. So that, to me, suggests a guy with position versatility. I've spoken with him. He seems like a bright kid, good attitude, and this is a good get for FSU. You want to keep stacking those 4 stars and 5 stars.
Yeah, great get. Talented year for Georgia, Central Georgia, with the linemen. I know we've talked about the Trey Hill kid, who's also from Warner Robins. Goes to a different high school, but that's one of the better interior line prospects in the country. And Armstrong, not that level of prospect, but big body, good get, and just another real kind of athletic piece that I agree with you could potentially work out at multiple spots on the line.
Yeah, I really like Trey Hill, by the way. If they somehow pull that kid, that's one of the better guard prospects. He's not a tackle. He's just a pure guard. But that, mm-hmm. As a guard, he is really good.
Yeah. Talented year in the state of Georgia, and Florida State certainly involved with their fair share of kids. Bud, another question that we received. What are your thoughts on Malik Zaire headed to go Gator? And does it affect their win share? How much? And are they a threat in the swamp? I'll let you answer that with a little bit of a background as far as what you said last week, deciding between Miami and Florida as the two more looming opponents.
Yeah, I think he's an upgrade, potentially, over Franks. And he certainly upgrades their roster, right? So whether it's Franks or Zaire, and we don't necessarily know yet, I think most people figure it'll be Zaire, because otherwise, why would you transfer there? If you're him, but Florida's roster is automatically deeper now. If one quarterback gets hurt, the guy who's coming in is the guy who you didn't think you'd be able to have as a backup just a couple months ago. I got to see Malik out at the Elite 11 stuff. He was out there as one of the kind of college counselor types. First day, he looked really rough. I didn't realize it was him until after a while, and somebody said, "What do you think of Zaire?" And I was like, "Zaire who?" And I, to be honest, I kind of figured he was like one of the local high school kids that they just brought on because one of the kids missed his flight and showed up late. They wanted to have an even number. But days 2 and 3, he was a lot better, as were all the quarterbacks there. So I don't know if there was just some rust to knock off or whatever. I know those guys have been hanging out there on the West Coast for a while. Look, I think he's probably better than Franks at this point, and I think he makes that team better. But I don't think he makes them like a national title contender or anything.
I agree. I mean, I think you have a chance to see an increased level of play from Zaire, just because I think if people are in, like, particularly, I don't know if I would label it a toxic environment, but no, what's surrounded Notre Dame football for a couple of years, I don't think has been the best of situations, particularly for the kids who play quarterback. So maybe they could move away and have a chance at, hitting the restart button and having a great year. So I think Zaire has a chance to improve that team, but I don't know that it will be any kind of transformational move. Although I will say, look, if you want to look at the high point of the Jim McElwain experience, it was very much in those first 7 or 8 games in which he had the kid whose name slips my mind that just transferred to West Virginia.
Greer.
Yeah, Will Greer. And he was healthy, and he was able to execute the system. And that was the best that Florida's looked in a long time. So, yeah, if you get a capable kid to come in and play, then maybe there is a much higher ceiling for the Florida team that we haven't otherwise seen.
Ingram, speaking of Jim McElwain and Florida, I do have to mention this. The 7th Annual Seminole Celebrity Inshore Classic, hosted by the Southwest Florida Seminole Club, is Saturday, July 15th. From Tween Waters on Captiva Island. And if y'all ever been out there, you know it's a beautiful setting, and it's a great tournament. Really kind of a unique event. We don't read a whole lot of Booster Club literature on here, but it's a fishing tournament. That's pretty badass. Snook and redfish. This year, they'll be featuring a Jim McElwain Shark Hunt Challenge. No joke. Former greats William Floyd and Lonnie Pryor will be there, and all proceeds go to the FSU Scholarship Endowment. for local high school grads going to Florida State, which is important because there's a lot of like Canes and Gators down here. Got to have more Noles down in Southwest Florida. Registration details, swflseminoles.com, or you can email maxhaney4@yahoo.com for direct inquiries. So July 15th, Inshore Fishing Tournament, benefit the FSU Scholarship Fund. That sounds pretty good.
Very, very good. Good little event, and hope that anybody down in Southwest Florida who has an interest is able to take advantage of that.
All right, where do we go from here? We got
let's go to the very much the land of the hypothetical, bud. I found this to be a pretty intriguing question, and I know this is something that caught your eye as well. We had a question asked: how bad of a college football team could you be, where you'd be able to put Tom Brady into your lineup and still have a legitimate chance of winning the national championship?
And we are changing this question up slightly from its original form, which had asked us, would you be odds against the field? So that would basically mean your odds would be better than anybody else in the field, like, or the field's odds combined. So we didn't want to answer that because that seems too easy. So this question, what team could we put Tom Brady on before you would say, no, they're not the national championship favorite? You want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about this right now. I don't know that I'll be able to give you a specific team. I could give you a classification of team. I would give you anybody. I think you could go down to a team that maybe a team that finishes 9-3, 8-4, a team that's ranked somewhere right around the maybe also receiving votes, a team that's 27th, 28th in the country.
Like NC State.
Something like that. Something similar to a solid team, good year, maybe bounces in and out of the poll, but not, you know, I'm not saying that you could grab some 3-8 team and all of a sudden make a run at the Final Four or the playoff. But, I think a good, solid, above-average college football team would probably be about as low as you could drop.
I think I'm there with you. Like, I thought back to it, and my mind was kind of like, all right, what recent teams that – like, okay, if you put Tom Brady on that Michigan State team that lost, like, 30-0 to Alabama, do we think that changes it? I mean, their quarterback did throw a lot of picks in that game, and Tom Brady probably wouldn't. You shouldn't – like, would – What if I gave Tom Brady to Wisconsin? Like, their quarterbacks are pretty much, with the exception of Russell Wilson, always pretty bad. Is Wisconsin now your title favorite?
I think that's a good level of team that you could throw that hypothetical at. Somebody that's like I said, somebody that is a 9-3 has some of the parts. I think we both agree that Aaron Rodgers would possibly be the more dangerous tool in college football if he was to be thrown out there. But Tom Brady is certainly a name that one or two people know about, and interesting little hypothetical question and something that was a little bit different than who do you think will win the second team running back spot or some of the other questions that we got with a decent amount of rotation.
It's a very June question. I like off-season questions. It's fun, man. We can't answer the same questions for 8 months in a row. All right, here's one for you. If I were to give you either FSU with Tom Brady, which would be really, really sick, or you could take the entirety of the group of the rest of the country for the title, you taking FSU with Tom Brady, or are you
this,
taking
this year's field? Installment of Florida State?
Yes, yeah.
I'd have a hard time not taking Florida State. There's some other quarterbacks that I might want to have just between what Florida State will be fielding that offensive line and how reliable and how much our wide receivers may not necessarily suit Tom Brady's game to a T, but going to have a real hard time giving me all the other pieces around that are in Tallahassee and then telling me a guy that routinely runs out and wins the last game of the year in the pros is not going to be my favorite to win the national championship in college football.
I think I have to agree with you, man. Yeah, I thought about it, and I was like, oh, he could get hurt, so I got to factor in that chance. But still, it's Tom Brady with FSU's roster, and everybody else is playing with not Tom Brady at quarterback. So that's a good question. I like hypotheticals like that. They can't be too crazy, but that – if you guys listen to Effectively Wild, the baseball podcast, they oftentimes have really fun questions like if Mike Trout had to play with like if he lost three fingers on his non-throwing hand, right? Could he still be the the league MVP or something like that? Or there was one. Oh, what if Mike Trout was only like by rule, but it was a secret rule. Somebody else knew about it, that he was only allowed to take one swing per at bat, and nobody else knew this, but he did, and it was the league wouldn't pick up on it for a while. How long would it take for them to adjust before they realize Mike Trout is only allowed to swing one time per bat? So if you have really fun hypotheticals like that, we can do some of those. We're not going to turn the entire show into hypotheticals, but that's kind of fun.
Next question, Bud. How badly do you think Jimbo Fisher wants to beat Alabama? Where does this rank on his scale of personal desires? Beneath national championship, but above rivals? Lower?
I think the questioner nailed it. I mean, listen to a Jimbo press conference. It's basically like you're walking into a museum. Right? He is so conscious of where – I don't want to say he's so conscious of where he stands like in history, but he knows history of sports so well. And I think that he is conscious of his legacy. Now, he won't come out and say it, and he's smart not to, because he has to keep this team level-headed for 12 and hopefully 15 games. But, this has got to be the game he's wanted to win the most in his career, with the exception of the Natty, right? I know he said he grew up an FSU fan and all that jazz, but I would say this one ranks right behind the national title and then probably right in front of 2010 UF, where he beat Urban Meyer.
Yep, that's the exact game I was going to throw out there.
Damn it, I should have quit talking. I jumped your answer.
No, I mean, we've talked about that game and the importance that it may have had on the program. Yeah, that first time he went down to Coral Gables and what Florida did. I mean, those are probably the four biggest individual games that I would think maybe he has another game in that rotation or in that top four. But that would be my guess. And that's a cool way of looking at it. If you really do think that your coach has as much, I guess, personal determination surrounding a game, what that really means for Florida State, your guess is as good as mine. But this would be outside the national championship game, I would think, probably the game that Jimbo Fisher would want to win the most out of those that he's coached at Florida State.
All right, Ingram, I'll hit you with this one. Do you foresee FSU using more two tight end sets in the first part of the season to help out in the run game and in more in pass pro?
I think I do. We've talked about this for a long time. I mean, we've talked about this really since the inception of the podcast, off and on, about Florida State's desire to want to use two tight ends. I mean, I had a long time ago, I had a friend of mine on the staff, and they wanted to use two tight ends the first time they went out to Norman, Oklahoma. And if you go back and ever watch that game, you'll see that's the formation that is announced out of that's the TV player roster is a two tight end set. Now, that doesn't mean a damn thing, but Florida State wanted to try some of that and very quickly learned that they didn't have the specimens or the roster to get anything out of that. So I know that's a desire. I know that's something that Jimbo Fisher wants at like the base of his offense to be able to do. But that desire has been there for a long time, and I haven't really seen it so come to fruition. But if you look at the way they're recruiting, you look at their roster, I think a two tight end set could be one of the more damaging groupings of offensive talent that they could put out on the field this year.
I'm with you on that. As long as Saunders becomes a little bit better blocker. Now, part of this, like you said, is going to be consistency of receivers. Do you have enough receivers you can trust? Because if you only have two, are you going to run a lot of three receiver sets out there? I don't know. Maybe you want to. Early in the season includes the Alabama game, but it also includes some other important games. Get some really good defenses who are really great up front, like NC State and Miami. Both have elite level front sevens. Miami probably a little better linebackers. NC State a little better defensive lines. It's certainly a good idea to try this out early on in the year. I'm all for it, and I think they will. I mean, you have two guys who are entering your fourth year at tight end. Let's do it.
No better time for this want to actually come a reality. So that'll be that'll be one of the larger storylines that I pay attention to, both leading into the Alabama game, but more, you know, what the offensive personnel and the formations look like for game 3, 4, and 5. Bud, we have a question. Received a lot of questions similar to this one, actually, so this may be more a morphing of questions surrounding this particular individual. But George Campbell, where do we see him in his development at Florida State, and do we see him necessarily becoming a deep ball threat this year?
Ingram, I believe you're violating the rule that we set out like 3 months ago, where we do not take George Campbell questions until he actually does something on the field. Right, the show me rule.
Yes, so, yes. You nominated the show me rule, and I just walked right through it.
I'm invoking the show me rule. In fairness, I actually put the question here on our show notes sheet, so I kind of walked you into it. My answer stays the same. Until he does something, I don't want to speculate on his ultimate potential. Let's just see if he can stay healthy for like a stretch of, I don't know, half a season first. It sucks that George is a nice kid, has not been able to stay healthy. Let's hope he can, and we'll talk about him once he does.
But like where we are at the podcast, nice list of questions that we've been able to tackle so far, and a couple of good ones left. Want to just thank the listeners for these. We won't be able to get to all of them, but we'll do something in the near future that incorporates these. And if we're going to thank our listeners, probably a good time to thank our sponsor and talk about our friends real briefly with the Ford the Table Restaurant Group.
Yeah, man. Madison Social, Central, and Township. Great job there by Ford the Table to keep growing the business. And we're glad to be a very small part of that. And we're very happy that they continue to sponsor us. We always tell you about once a month about the pancakes at Madison Social's brunch. Madso, for those of y'all who don't know, it's like an upscale sports pub. It's not the typical greasy sports pub food. It's a little classier. Good food, good drinks, good sights, nice atmosphere. Next month's stack for July. Check this out. Mocha latte pancakes. It's espresso buttermilk pancakes topped with chocolate espresso syrup, chocolate chips, caramel, and whipped cream. And judging from the early returns that they have on their Instagram page with friends tagging other friends, there's a whole lot of like, OMG, I need this. And looks like we need to make a trip back up to Tallahassee early to get some pancakes, eight friends tagged. So that seems popular. I would also like to enjoy that. And I'm going to be in Tallahassee next month, so I probably will enjoy that one of those days. They also, at Central, check this out. This is their great Italian joint. You know, the 30th is National Mai Tai Day. They're saying, let's get tiki, Mai Tais, and free mini porchetta and pineapple pizzas. So I'm down with that. And then triple ad read today.
Yeah, just will remind people, this is possible for any of the three restaurants, I believe, but I potentially would keep Central in the back of your mind with this one. Delivery is possible if you're a student and away from Tallahassee, or if you're there for summer school, or if you're just a resident of Tallahassee in general. Always remember that you don't necessarily even have to go to the physical premise. You can work out a delivery with Central using either Penny Delivers or Doorstep Delivery. You can go to centralitalian.com to find out more details. But delivery is possible. And there's three really impressive menus. But if you're going to talk to me and talk to me about delivery food, would point you in the direction of the pizzas that that Central offers.
It is really good.
How important are shoe companies in recruiting?
They're not unimportant, I guess. How much can I say here? If you are familiar with basketball recruiting, right, and the AAU circuit and how there are like Adidas teams and Nike teams and Under Armour teams, and it seems like somehow these kids seem to be tied. Like if you're on an Under Armour team and you're a real stud, your rate of going to an Under Armour school is basically like 100%. And similar if you're, you know, on a Adidas team or a Nike team or whatever. It's not like that yet in football. AAU ball is not determining it, or excuse me, 7-on-7, which is kind of the college football's version of AAU. It's not 100% like that yet. But it is absolutely, when I'm looking at where will national kids go, I do pay attention to it. And if I don't know where a kid's going to go and I think there's a lot of really good options for him, I might actually use it as like a tie-breaking factor. But I don't think, for the most part, that it's one of these things where, okay, this kid plays on an Adidas 7-on team, he's definitely going to go play for an Adidas 7-on school. I take note of it, but I don't think it's quite where basketball was or is.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not there. So we've heard a lot about this recently, and locally here, a lot of people have wondered about Justin Fields. He's on an Under Armour team. He's not just on an Under Armour 7-on-7 team. He's on the one that's named for and coached by Cam Newton. And whether that might lead to a tie-in to Auburn for reasons that aren't necessarily specific or dependent upon who provides them with athletic apparel. I happen to have somebody that's fairly close to the Justin Fields recruitment, and I asked him about this. And just his personal opinion was that that would have no impact on where he went. So that's just one specific example that's not necessarily disproving this belief that seems to be growing stronger that the shoe game is impacting where college kids go and maybe slated to follow a similar path as basketball. But like you said, we're not there yet, and I'm not sure if that's something that's going to fully come to fruition or just something that people have more of a concern about because they've seen what happened in basketball.
I totally agree. And each situation is different, right? Like Fields has –
each situation is very, very different.
Fields has parents who are legitimately involved in his recruitment and care about where he goes and are, you know, helping him gather information and whatnot. It's not like he's like being led solely by his AAU coach. So by the way – on Cam Newton, that's a cool guy, man. Like I know
he's a real good yeah. guy who seems to do things for really good reasons and not a whole lot else. So
I've been around him impressive. With the cameras off a lot. Just had these 7-on-7 events, but you know, like before the championship day, and where there's not a camera crew out there, where the local news is not trying to talk to him. I've seen him like sit in a portable trailer during rain delays for hours on end when a lot of these other guys could have left IMG and. You know, a lot of these NFL guys probably would have gone up to, gone up to Hard Rock or something, just up the road in Tampa. And he's very much a guy who cares about the kids and couldn't give a damn about like these adult autograph chasers who are going to put the stuff on eBay.
Right.
Like he really is not nice to those people, but is really like all about the kids, even with the cameras off. And I think that's cool because there's definitely some athletes out there. Who are just doing it for the PR, and he's legitimately not.
Good good note there, yeah, and good to hear about Mr. Newton and what he's involved with. Bud, a question that was posed is, do you think Florida State will have another Louisville game, or will we make sure that everyone knows their job?
All right, so by Louisville game, I assume he means losing by, what was the 43 points? Right?
Yeah. Something like could that. Could have had 80 scored on you. Whatever barometer you choose to judge that game by, but yeah.
That seems like a lot of points. Most in school history, I think, right? Or pretty close to it.
I think it was. I think it very much was.
All right. So my answer is, at least as it pertains to this season, no. Will FSU, assuming it keeps playing ball for like the next 100 years or something, will they ever lose by more than 43? I think the odds say yeah. Like eventually somebody will beat them by more than 43. Probably very, very far down the road. Maybe college football looks a lot different. Maybe it's more like 7-on-7 type football in the future. This year, though, I think you got to feel very strong saying no, right? Nobody's going to beat them by that margin, I don't believe, for a couple reasons. Number one, I think they'll be healthier this year on defense, knock on wood. Number two, I think they'll be better coached and that they'll buy into the coaching more because I feel like they actually did so down the stretch last year. Number three, quality of competitions as far as the quarterbacks you face this year. The only guy you face this year, I think, who scares you like that is actually the guy that did see you last year. So take that with a grain of salt, but he did lose some weapons around him. I don't think his defense will get quite as many stops against FSU this year. And I'm predicting FSU to win that game, so I definitely don't think that's going to happen. But Yeah, I mean, look, the point of the question is well taken. We just fielded the question, you know, why doesn't FSU have the best defense in the country predicted by ESPN's guy? And yet this questioner comes and hits us with, hey, they're going to lose by 4. They're going to give up 60-something again? You know? So it shows that this team does have improvement to make from last year.
Good juxtaposition made there, Bud, and I agree. Good solid reminders to some of the lesser than stellar performances that were witnessed, particularly at the beginning of the season. Outside of rivals, Miami, Florida, Clemson listed here, and Bama, who are the toughest matchups for this season? Question seems to hint at perhaps it's Louisville because of what they have at quarterback, or NC State because of their defense.
I mean, I think he nailed it. Do you have a preference between those two? I guess I can take the other so we can have some disagreement.
Yes, disagreement. Look, anytime you got a player like you do at quarterback, regardless of whether or not you're going to be playing him home or away, I would love defense, and I love what NC State has along the line of scrimmage, but I'm not going to not choose the defending Heisman Trophy winner.
All right, good, because I'm going to take NC State because of where the game falls directly after the Miami game. It's a clear trap situation. And I've got a guy who is really, really connected to NC State. And he told me, and I don't believe him, but I take it, you know, I certainly took note of it when he said it. He told me NC State is the best defensive line in the country. And I was like, okay. But still, even if they don't, for him to actually believe that, and he's not somebody who I think is a crazy person, that shows that they're going to be very difficult to block. And given that it's a hangover game after Miami, that is a game you should probably circle and likely bet the under and be prepared for like an ugly slog of a game, hard-hitting, low-scoring, sloppy, hope you hold on to the football, survive it, and then, you know, get to week five type game. So I'll take NC State because you took Louisville, because otherwise I'm taking Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, good points pointed out, though, or good things pointed out for how the NC State game sets up. And man, that's a hell of a first four games of the year: NC State, Miami, and Alabama. To go ahead and bite that piece off, we'll certainly have a very good idea as to what this team looks like and what's possible after a trip to Raleigh.
Let me ask you a question. If you get out of that stretch right there at 2-1, but the one is a close loss, regardless of who it's to, you feeling pretty good about the year?
I am. Yes, I am. I would starting to put a qualifier on it to who it was. Really, I think you can survive if it's a close loss, then you would have had suffered a close loss, gotten your stuff together, presumably gotten through week two with no injuries, then gone out and beaten Miami and NC State back-to-back and very much put yourself in a place to pursue the road that is necessary to get yourself back into the playoffs. And look, the losses I would prefer, it would probably read Miami, NC State, Miami. If I just said Miami twice, I'm an idiot. I meant Alabama, NC State, Miami. Obviously, if you lose to Alabama close, I don't think anything's taken off the table. And if you lose to the NC State, then that may not bite you as much in recruiting and would still give you a chance to win 10 times in a row against Miami, which is silly and dumb, but would be pretty spectacular at the same time. So if you're letting me rank these three as to what I would want, but with your overall sentiment, I'm in complete agreement. And if you're 2-1 with a close loss, then I think you've got to feel okay about where you are and what is possible for the rest of the season.
Well said, man. All right, here's one for you. Who would you like to see FSU face in a week one neutral site game?
The immediate team that comes to mind, I'd love to see Florida State play USC. They opened up with USC like 1996, 97, somewhere in that area. It was Travis Miner's first game, so it would have had to have been 27, I believe, or 27, 97. So they opened in Los Angeles and had a home-and-home where USC came back and played Florida State. But those are just two awesome uniforms and doesn't necessarily, since it's a neutral site game, I'll have that out somewhere in California and go ahead and sacrifice some of the support that would be able to travel. But I just think that'd be great for Florida State, and I'd love to see those two teams open up another college football season.
I love that. By the way, if you have access to it, go find the photos from that FSU-USC game. I've looked at them before, I think, in our SB Nation archives. The sunset, like the lighting on some of those photos from that game is, mm-hmm. I think it's the one out there in LA. It's just nuts. Ingram, that's a great pick right there. I got to tell you, for several reasons, not to mention I'm married into an LSU family, so there's this, but I would like to play LSU. FSU's not played LSU since, the 80s, I think, late 80s?
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking 30-something years now. That's a great place. I mean, obviously, it's a neutral site, so I can't pick that Union Tiger Stadium. Also, you get the angle of, like, Jimbo coming back to a place that simultaneously said he wasn't any good and then tried to give him, like, a record-breaking contract. So, you know, facing off there would be pretty neat. So, I mean, obviously you can't play the game in Death Valley if it's a neutral site, but I would like to play LSU. That'd be pretty cool. I mean, that's a lot of high-caliber athletes. I think that's what you want in these, right? You want to be able to play high-caliber athletes, storied programs, put them together, cut both schools a fat check, even though maybe Texas, too. I think FSU-Texas would be fun. I don't know the last time that happened. It's certainly been a long while. You have some FSU-Texas connections there. Mack Brown, FSU grad, coached at Texas, won their only relevant recent national title. That'd be fun, too. There's a lot of good schools you could do. You got any more? You got any other ideas on that?
No, I mean, I think the Texas is a great one. That would just be two iconic programs and two great looking uniforms out on the field. I'd like to. This is a little bit steering away from the opponent, but I'd love to see maybe Florida State do the game that seems to become an annual tradition over in Ireland. Now that's going to put a whole. That's going to throw your logistical patterns and stuff like that all out of the window. So maybe that's more appealing as a fan than it would be for an administrator or a coach or something like that to have to deal with that. But I do think that the general level of interest in Europe, Western Europe in particular, has risen considerably, even in the past 5 years. But I specifically think college football is an area of interest that hasn't ever previously existed over there. And I don't think Florida State needs to like go running all over the world to try to grow its fan base, but it wouldn't be a horrible thing if they didn't carve out a little bit of a brand over there with a lot of Europeaners who really seem to enjoy football and college football in particular.
I'd be down, man. FSU over there in Ireland or England, hell, put them in. Wait. What's that soccer team that actually does the chop? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's a team over in Turkey that does that, so I don't know if that's...
There's some logistical challenges associated with that.
May not be the place that we want to throw the lads over, but...
if they ever get that cleaned up, though, that'd be pretty cool to go to a quote-unquote neutral site where their home fans actually do the chop already. Yeah,
it's a great call. Great call.
All right, here we go. How do you foresee the carry distribution between Patrick and Akers? Keep Patrick in short yardage roles, or do we get split backfields, touches? What do you guys see?
Well, I would I've commented many times on it's a little bit of a mystery to me as to why we didn't see more of Patrick last year, particularly with the effort and kind of the evolution of the running back that we thought Jimbo Fisher wanted him to turn into. So I'm going to have a hard time handicapping exactly what type of performance you'll see from Akers, just out of the past recognition that if I saw what I saw last year, I would have predicted a hell of a lot larger involvement with him in the offense. Obviously, number four isn't there anymore, but I seem to get this feeling that Akers is going to be a little bit more, at least with the obvious stipulation on if he's healthy, that Akers going to be a little bit more the marquee running back. At least that's my own particular opinion from just the information that I've consumed over the past 2 months or so.
I'm there with you, man. Look, do I think Cam Akers is going to start day one? Yeah, I kind of do. But what I'm more confident in is I think if he's healthy, that Cam Akers will be the leading rusher on the team this year. I just, from what guys on this staff have said, specifically to people who I know, and I don't think they would just bullshit them, I'm very confident Cam Akers is going to be a stud for FSU. And I think it probably happens sooner than later. So I'm going to say, look, I don't think Cam Akers is going to take all the carries and Patrick's just going to get, you know, purely second team reps. I think they're going to mix them up decently. But if I had to bet on somebody being the leading rusher, I definitely would bet on Cam Akers.
In more or less in agreement there. All right, bud, two final questions here tonight that we'll get into. First of which comes from Bob Rice. Bob sent us this via Twitter, and he asked a good question, and that is, what attributes distinguish a strong side linebacker prospect from a weak side one, a free safety versus strong safety? And then he says, P.S., living in New York, love the Nolcast, and use it as a way to stay in touch with the team. So, Bob, very much appreciate your listenership. And, Bud, what's your initial response to his question?
All right, so let's just take this as a standard, like, 4-3 defense, because otherwise it gets a little more complicated if you're going to be talking about a 34. So in a 4-3 defense, the 4 stands for down linemen. You have 4 of them, 2 tackles and 2 ends. And then the 3 stands for your backers, strong, middle, and weak, also known as Sam, Mike, and Will, if you want to go with some coach parlance there. So what does a strong side backer need to do? Typically, if you're playing more of a 4-3 under front, right, the strong backer is going to be more up on the line of scrimmage, aligned with the tight, basically in over the top of the tight end. So he has to be better at taking on blocks at the line of scrimmage. Typically, your strong side backers are a little bit longer. They're a little bit more physical. They may need to cover the tight end down the field, but what we're probably not going to ask them to do is cover quite as much ground like in zone coverage. Oftentimes, strong side linebackers don't have quite the big tackle numbers, but it is very important they set the edge. Sometimes they're the force player to where you're going to have a guy come run the alley and make the tackle behind him. The weak side backer, he can't be weak, but when you think about weak side backer, think like a Telvin Smith, right? What do you want to do? So let's go back to our 4-3 under set where you had the defensive line, the right end oftentimes is over there, kind of out in space. You got your left side reduced. You've got the strong side backer up on the tight end. Like, he's trying to jam that tight end, especially on run plays. Doesn't want to let that tight end hook him so that the play can't bounce outside. The weak side backer is typically more protected against blockers coming out and blocking him. He's oftentimes your guy who's real quick. He's going to run around and make a lot of tackles. He's a sure tackler in the open field. He has the speed and the quickness to go sideline to sideline. And how do you do it? Like, Derek Brooks is your classic prototype weak side backer. Tampa Bay would protect him. He would not have to take on very many blocks when he played there. He was at his best when he could run around and chase down ball carriers and play in space. So your weak side backer is typically more your space guy. Your strong side backer is typically more of your length, speed guy. Classically here, think in a very recent defense, think Christian Jones, strong side, Telvin Smith, weak side.
Yeah, there's all kind of historical examples. You can look, Michael Boulware, Kendall Pope, all kinds of different examples that you could point to people. But yeah, I think that's a good description there as to what to look for.
Lawrence Timmons is another good strong side example.
Timmons was a fantastic strong side.
Hell of a player.
Unbelievably.
If he had played when FSU was actually good, he would have been like much more famous, right?
He would be regarded as one of the better. He wouldn't be Marvin. He wouldn't be the number 10 that you just mentioned a second ago either. But I fully think that he would be regarded as one of the best 3 or 5 linebackers to – I think he would be right there in that next classification of kids. I do.
I agree. And I think if you ask folks, hey, who are the best 5 linebackers at FSU of all time? I think most people are not going to say Lawrence Timmons, but I'm not so sure they shouldn't. I think he's at least in the conversation for that top 5. And certainly if you look at kind of his continued arc in the NFL, I mean, the guy is on what is like third contract or something?
He's entering in his 10th year, I believe. So, yeah.
Yeah, he graduated, what, 06?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he's 10th season. I just read an article about Vince moving into more of his responsibilities in Pittsburgh with him moving out there. But hell of a career, incredible player, and one of the few bright spots of that that generation for Florida State fans.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. And we know Pittsburgh will cut linebackers loose with a quickness if they don't think they can play anymore. Right. So to last that long there is very impressive. We got one more, Ingram, to end on. This is from T-Wheel23. Question for the pod. How good do you think James Blackman can be? And if FSU were to get Justin Fields, do you think he passes him?
Let me just jump in real quickly. I'll say that Blackman has a ton of potential, real raw product. We've talked a couple times. We've also talked about how well Blackman and Hawkman complemented each other. And another thing that we said at the time that I'll just remind people, one of the brilliant things about that class is that you got your raw product, you got, and then you're able to juxtapose that with the coach's son, the product that's a little more polished, ready to give you immediate playing time, or at least not embarrass you, hopefully, if he has to be thrown into playing time if something were to happen to Francois. But neither of those kids, more importantly, dissuade a five-star prospect from coming to your campus either. So a great pairing of kids lets you fill a need on a roster, lets you put two intriguing prospects for their own right, but not kids that are going to keep other large five-star type prospects like Fields away.
Man, I think you summed it up beautifully there. Now, do I think Fields would pass Blackman? If I had to bet on it, yeah. Do I think it's an absolute lock? No, because like you just said, I think Blackman does have quite the high ceiling. Now, Fields is more advanced at the same age, but I don't think it's an absolute lock. This is why, like, there's no certainties in this. This is why you have to keep stacking talent on top of talent, not just rest on your laurels.
Certainly at this position. Well, Bud, I think that'll, you know, again, we were never going to be able to get to all the questions, but that's a real good sampling of them. Like I said, we've saved these. We'll be able to circle back, hopefully do something similar in the next 10 days or so, and know that if we didn't get to your question, we still have it. Appreciate the response. Incredible, overwhelming. And thank you again for all the support you've given us over the years. And I know it's June, and conversations may vary a little bit, but certainly a lot of excitement starting to build up within this fan base for this season, and for the first game of the season in particular, and just real excited and real fortunate to be able to be in a place to continue to bring you a podcast like this. So thank you to all the listeners, and look forward to what the future holds.
I stand at your gate, and the song that I sing is of moonlight. I stand and I wait for the touch of your hand in the June night. The roses are sighing, a moonlight serenade. The stars are aglow, and tonight how their light sets me dreaming.